Welcome to the Interior Health Nursing Grand Rounds, a podcast conversation. I am your host, Allison Thomas, and on this podcast, we talk all things nursing and healthcare. I work as the clinical nurse specialist in the Trauma Services Network in Interior Health. Interior Health would like to recognize and acknowledge the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Dakal Dene, Tanaha, Ingla Katma, Shawepam, Statliam, Sioux, and Chicoltean nations, where we live, learn, collaborate, and work together. I'm so pleased to reintroduce you to a special guest today. We have Dr. Mary Corvin with us. And Mary, welcome. We've met you before, but would you mind just doing a quick introduction of yourself? And since we're going to be talking about continence care today, maybe about how you came to be interested in this specific topic.
Sure. Thanks, Allison. So I'm a clinical nurse specialist in gerontology, and that is probably where I started to realize the impact of continence on people. Although older adults are more at risk, if people go away with one thing from this conversation today, I'd like them to appreciate that it's not a normal process of aging. Older people are more at risk for a number of reasons. So that's where I started to notice it. And my director at the time suggested that I take the nurse continence advisor certification, and she supported me to do that. And when I looked into it, it's from McMaster University, and it was an 18-month program. Mm. And I remember saying to her, boy, there must be a lot to learn about continence if it's an 18-month program. And it's like anything, you start to delve into it and you start to learn and you start to understand, you start to appreciate how little you know, mm-hmm. still know, and how much more there is to learn about it. Then I just was in the optimal position, I guess, with my CNS role in gerontology to incorporate it in that continence practice in as one of my domains of the clinical nurse specialist mm-hmm. role. So as you know, the four domains are clinical practice, system leadership, advancement of nursing practice, and evaluation and research. And while it might look on the surface that the continence practice meets the clinical component, I also incorporate those other domains. So mm-hmm. it was never my intent to be the nurse continence advisor within Interior Health. I really wanted to mentor other nurses into it because you don't have to be a clinical nurse specialist mm-hmm. to fill that role. And in other areas, you know, registered nurses, LPNs are actually filling that role now too. McMaster has opened that program up to LPNs.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So the nursing backgrounds gives you the fundamental knowledge, and then it's a specialized practice. And when I say specialized practice, I don't mean specialized practice as far as our regulator identifies specialized mm-hmm. practice, but it's another tool in your tool belt.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is interesting. And I think you made me think about how, for myself, in my nursing career, I've stumbled into everything good, and everything that I enjoy in my career has just been mm-hmm. by accident. And I kind mm-hmm. of hear maybe that was an accidental part of your practice, but I think you're quite passionate about it now. So how fun.
Yeah, I love it. And it's invisible. That's the other thing, mm-hmm. Allison, is the fact that, I mean, I'm not the only one now. We do have another nurse continence advisor working in the Seniors Health and Wellness Center in Kamloops that I helped mentor into that role. But there's only two of us, and mm-hmm. we're attached to the seniors portfolio. So there's a whole demographic of people that aren't being served with this service. So I just see such a great need and so many opportunities. And there's so much that other healthcare providers can pick up within their scope and start the conversation and start something. I always say that any of us can do something. Mm-hmm. And if mm-hmm. it's just spreading the word that it's not a normal process of aging and there's things that we can do to prevent it and to intervene, I think is the first step.
Excellent. Could you tell me what it looks like when you do a continence assessment? Kind of what are the pieces or what are the things you're looking for?
Sure. So my practice for an initial assessment, I schedule an hour and a half. And that's partly because I sometimes, most often, I'm not just doing just the focused continence assessment, because the older adult is the patient or the client. There's often other things going on too. So I might do a cognitive assessment, a quick mini mental, or other things. So, and it takes time to build trust to ask some of these questions. So a geriatrician once told me that she always remembers three S's when she talks about continence. Okay. It's a secret, it's a sensitive topic, and it's a symptom of a pathophysiological response. So something has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not normal progression, right? So that's why, I mean, I'm very privileged to have an hour and a half to do that. And other healthcare providers, for example, nurse practitioners and physicians, don't have that. Mm-hmm. So I can do that comprehensive assessment and then send that report to them to do their part of it. So the initial assessment is scheduled for an hour and a half. And the first thing that I do is, it's like a baseline evaluation. So the first thing I do is I ask, what's their personal goal for seeing me? And often they haven't really thought too much about that. They've been referred because they've been referred to the center, and I'm a component of that center. And it came out maybe in their initial intake that they were leaking urine or stool. And so they get tracked towards me. Mm-hmm. But I ask them to identify a SMART goal. And sometimes it's things like, I'd like to learn more about bowel and bladder health. I'd like to stop the leaking. I'd like some advice on different pads to wear. And so that opens a different conversation, because mm-hmm. I try and get people off pads, to be mm-hmm. honest. It's a solution that we see that's marketed. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about that. It's a complex conversation in some ways, but the anatomy and physiology and what's going on with our bodies is, I don't want to say simple, because our bodies aren't simple. But I often compare it to what we've done with oral health. Like, we all understand that we should brush our teeth, mm-hmm. right? We should floss. Most of us floss, try and floss, get regular checkups if we are able to do that. And we've reduced, like, kids hardly ever get cavities anymore because it's safe mm-hmm. to talk about. But with bowel and bladder health, they really haven't thought about it. It's been a secret, and it just hasn't been safe to talk about. So mm-hmm. I open up the conversation with, what would you like to happen as a result of seeing me? We write down their goals, and then I do a confidence score. So the confidence score is like a Likert scale from 0 to 10. Mm-hmm. And the questions go something like this: how confident are you that you can hold your urine? And the first one is without leaking one drop, long enough to get to the bathroom in time when you're at home. So I ask a number of those questions. They give me a score. If they're wearing a pad, I know that they have no confidence. Mm-hmm. So it's not about whether they're leaking or not. It's about confidence. The goal, the confidence score, and then a quality of life. So I ask the question, if you were to spend the rest of your life with your urinary bowel condition the way it is now, how would you feel about that? And then the questions are, they'd feel delighted, pleased, mostly satisfied, mixed, mostly dissatisfied, unhappy, or terrible. And so that gives me a baseline on, it's another way of putting it is degree of bother. Mm-hmm. So they might be leaking a little bit with stress when they cough, sneeze, and they're wearing a panty liner, and they're okay with that right now because mm-hmm. they really enjoy their coffee, their glass of wine in the evening, right? These are culprits that can cause mm-hmm. that. So my role then is to provide the information, and then they make an informed choice. And then I make it very clear that there's no judgment from me. Mm-hmm. So they choose how they're going to manage their incontinence depending on their goals with lifestyle and those sorts of things. So we start mm-hmm. with that. And then I do a in-depth interview. So the interview starts with their history. Like, is it urinary incontinence and fecal, or just urinary incontinence? When did it start? How long has it been going on? And I always ask the question, what do you think caused the problem? Mm. And many of them say they don't know. And some of them are very astute. Like they think that having five babies or having a large baby and that mm-hmm. is absolutely can be a cause, but it's not the only, it's mm-hmm. not the only cause. And it doesn't mean you can't recover from that. Right. Mm-hmm. So with this generation, episiotomies were standard mm-hmm. practice, right? So a lot of the women have had some trauma to their pelvic floor. And anything that causes trauma to your pelvic floor impacts the function. Mm-hmm. But there's ways to get that function back, depending on the cause. Most people, well, I shouldn't say most, we're becoming more aware of the pelvic floor. But when I was doing my preceptorship, where I was seeing people from a different population, a younger mm-hmm. population, mm-hmm. younger women who were athletes, many of them were ripped in their abdomen, like had a mm-hmm. six pack in their abdomen, but had a saggy pelvic floor. And they had symptoms where they would leak urine in short spurts with exertion. Like with one young woman played floor hockey. So every time she lunged, she would leak urine. So yeah, I talk about those types of things, what they thought caused the problem. Then I get an assessment about how frequently they void during the day. Do they void every 2 hours, every 20 minutes? Because mm-hmm. all that impacts your bladder. And then I do a lot of teaching about their anatomy and physiology. So mm-hmm. I explain the bladder as a muscle, as an organ, and it's not unlike other muscles in your body. So to keep it healthy, you need to stretch it appropriately, not overstretch it, mm-hmm. overfill it, but you need to stretch it enough. Often when people are thinking about reducing the amount that they're leaking, they will void more often, but they're actually reducing the capacity of their bladder. Mm-hmm. If you think like other muscles, right? Because mm-hmm. they're not exercising it appropriately. So all of this gives me information with just a general assessment, I guess. So I go through a number of things with the interview. I ask about their medical history, because there's some things, as we know, anything that impedes the brain will impede the bladder. Mm-hmm. So, and a cognitive impairment, dementia is it's tricky because you have to be able to process the information and implement the behavior modifications. So if a person's not able to do that, I'm not necessarily the best person for mm-hmm. them to see, I guess, mm-hmm. unless they have a very dedicated care provider. Mm-hmm. But I often see couples where one of them has been scheduled to see me, but the other one is picking up all this information too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think we can all pick up something from it. So getting back to the medical history, things like Parkinson's disease, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, all of those impact the brain and can cause some degree of neuropathy, which then impacts your bladder. Anxiety, depression, those things. So people that are anxious will often void every 20 minutes, every 30 minutes. And I've seen a lot of that, an increase in that. This is just anecdotally in my clinic mm-hmm. since COVID, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Then I ask about their bowels. I always say you can't talk about urinary function and health without talking about bowels. And I use the Bristol stool chart. So the Bristol yeah. stool chart is, I think everyone should have it in their bathroom so that they actually look at their stools. And a lot of it is giving them permission to do this without thinking that it's creepy. And I encourage women especially to use a mirror and to look at their anatomy. Many women haven't done that, especially mm-hmm. this patient mm-hmm. population, so that they have an idea of the baseline of their anatomy and they can check on their tissues every once in a while. We always check our face, right? We're mm-hmm. looking for blemishes and changes. It's the same down below too. Getting back to bowels, the key with bowels, so when we talk about the Bristol stool chart, it's a scale that shows stools consistency and the way they look from 1 to 7. 1 is those hard constipated balls and 7 is pure liquid and everything in between. And the optimal one is type 4, which is smooth like a sausage, doesn't leak out on its own, but is easy when you sit down on the toilet and relax your sphincter that you can pass it easily. As we know, we absorb most of our hydration fluid from our stool in the large bowel, right? And if we're not drinking enough water, most often people will be constipated. So the number one thing, and this is the piece that we all need to know, we should all be drinking 4 to 6 cups. So those are imperial cups. One cup equals 250 mils. So that equates to 1500 to 2000 mils spread out throughout the day. Mm-hmm. So from when you get up in the morning and stopping at 6 o'clock at night, unless there's a caveat, unless you're on fluid restrictions for some reason, like heart issues or renal issues. And I can tell you, it's not easy to do that because I know this stuff and I have to schedule it in and make myself drink like a cup at a time to get it in. Mm-hmm. The reason I say to stop at 6 o'clock at night is as you age. So again, talking about my specific patient population, as we age, our hormones change. I'm not talking about estrogen. Well, I'll talk about estrogen too, but in this situation, it's antidiuretic hormone. So our antidiuretic hormone drops, which predisposes older people to getting up at night. So anything we can do to reduce the amount of times you're getting up at night, because if you're getting up, you're not getting that quality sleep that puts you at risk for delirium and all sorts of things, right? We need our sleep and a non-drug sleep is best. So anything we can do to optimize that sleep. So, and you know, people will tell me their behaviors or I guess their habits and they'll say, well, I get so thirsty at night. But if you get that water in during the day, often you won't be thirsty at night. But it's a change, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why bowel function is so important is, again, if you're stretching the anus, you can get fissures, right? Mm-hmm. And those fissures are like little tears. And those tears will heal, but they'll heal with scar. And as you know, scar doesn't have the optimal function, isn't as elastic as our original tissue. Plus the stool in the lower part of the colon and the rectum can push up against the bladder. So now instead of having the succinct muscle that's contracting when you go to void, there could be a pocket of urine that's trapped because the stool is pushing up. So you're not emptying completely. And if you're not empty completely and flushing that bladder out, you're more at risk for urinary tract infection. So it's like a number of things impacting it. There's the strength of your pelvic floor. The other thing I was going to say, I teach Kegel exercises to groups, but I won't teach Kegel exercises to anyone in my clinic without assessing them, without doing an internal vaginal exam and or an internal rectal exam. Because in my clinic, I'm doing that comprehensive assessment and my interventions are based on that assessment. So I don't want to say, and this is the key piece why we need to assess in clinics, is some people can't identify their pelvic floor.
Yeah.
So because of a number of reasons, and if they can't identify their pelvic floor and squeeze those pelvic muscles, it's a waste of time for me to be teaching them and for them to be trying it, and they'll assume wrongly that Kegels don't work and that we have number one research, capital R research, that Kegels do work. You have to do them just like any other exercise, not just think about doing them, but they do work, but you have to do them right too. So the way we learned when I had my babies, like 40, I think my daughter's 45 now, is different. We've learned a different way because of research, right? So that's a piece of it. So getting back to what I do in my clinic, I do the baseline evaluation of where they are, then my interview, which incorporates all these pieces. Then I take them to the bathroom and I ask them to void into one of those collection, I call them a pee hat, because that's what it looks like, right? And so that we put it under the toilet seat, they pee in there, they void in there, I measure that, and then we do a post-void residual to see if they're retaining urine. And then I do the physical assessment with an internal vaginal, internal rectal, and then we come back and talk about some options. I also do a urinary dipstick, but not for UTIs. I use it to corroborate, I guess, my information with if I think that they're dehydrated, then I can check the specific gravity just to see if that information matches. So I'm doing these assessments in different pieces and you can kind of see it come together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I do, I send them home with homework. And part of that is a in and out assessment, but it's avoiding drinking and bowel assessment. I clean out that pee hat and send it home with them. And I ask them in a 24-hour period, every time they void, to void into this collection chamber, mm-hmm. measure it. There's great calibrations on it. Write it down on the sheet, dump it, and do that for 24 hours. Then they have a really good idea, and I do too. They bring it back for their follow-up assessment on how much and what mm-hmm. time they're peeing. I do a baseline assessment with that in the clinic with the interview where I'll say, how much and what do you drink from the time you get up in the morning until breakfast? What do you drink between breakfast and lunch? What do you drink between lunch? So I've got an idea, but this is more specific when they go home to follow up with that. And when I do that initial assessment of fluids, I'll often hear that all they drink is coffee mm-hmm. and they don't like water. And so it's education about, I mean, I love my coffee too, but I've learned that I have to flush my bladder out to keep it healthy. And I often tell the story that I didn't get a UTI until I became a nurse. And that was from working 12-hour shifts on a busy surgical floor, right? So I'd get my coffee on the way to work. That's all I would drink all day long. And I wouldn't void all day long because you don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't taking anything in either. And I ended up with a UTI. And now we know, we've learned that antibiotics aren't necessarily the first response mm-hmm. to a UTI. If we can push fluids and heal that bladder and flush that out, we can often treat a UTI.
Mm-hmm.
So it's putting all these pieces together and understanding how our body works and how we can put it in the best homeostatic position, I guess, to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. I find it so fascinating. I always learn so much from you. but I hear you speaking and I hope that folks can take away your approach to how you're assessing patients. It's really person-centered and mm-hmm. you're asking obviously the right questions and some of them you need the specific information from your folks, but also these open-ended questions and mm-hmm. really what I think I hear is the most important thing to you is to understand how their incontinence impacts their quality of life and if there are any ways that we can improve their quality of life and giving them choices. And I just think that's such a wonderful approach to take. And as you say, you have the luxury of time with your patients.
I'm in such a privileged mm-hmm. position, Allison. I had my clinic yesterday. I started in Revelstoke on Wednesday and then had my clinic in Salmon Arm yesterday. And I just come home and I say to my husband, that's the best part of my role.
Mm-hmm.
I just mm-hmm. love it because you're in such a privileged position and you hear these stories from people. And when we see a little older lady who looks like Mrs. Santa Claus in my clinic and you make assumptions about that mm-hmm. and then you hear the stories behind it. And the fact that you have the privilege that they have opened up to you mm-hmm. and talked to you when they haven't talked to anybody about this before. And it's how their bowels and bladder are working, mm-hmm. right? They mm-hmm. they often have little pieces of information, like they knew that their mother leaked urine, but it wasn't talked about.
Yeah.
And so they thought it was just normal that if they mm-hmm. had babies, they would leak urine too.
Yeah.
And men, like I often have men come into my clinic wearing menstrual products because mm-hmm. that's what they know.
Yes.
And it's not a solution. Menstrual products don't wick away the urine and they don't, so they'll remain wet, mm-hmm. which causes, as you know, a lot of issues. and they don't manage the odor. And like I said, I never promise, but just when they understand how their body works and the interventions they can do, which is their control, there's often an option of, and it just depends, everybody's different and everybody's leaking different amounts, but there's hope that they don't have to rely on pads.
Mm-hmm. And I bet you're the first person to tell them that, you know.
Yeah,
it's such a,
yeah.
And, such a and special...
in fact, Allison, I'm not, my area of expertise is not continence products,
mm-hmm.
because of that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean there isn't a place for it. Just like there's a place for medication. But again, if we're taking a medication for overactive bladder, your bladder's overactive for a reason. It's your body telling you something. It's like when I get a tension headache when I'm at the computer. And so instead of getting up and stretching, I will go take an Advil and come right back and get back to it. So yes, there's a place for medication, but if we don't treat the cause, we're not treating the problem. I also tell the story about, I often see women in my clinic that have had a bladder lift 10, 20 years ago, and they had immediate gratification from that. Like, there's great results often. But often, if you don't treat the cause of what caused it, you'll end up back in the same place. And I keep hearing, nobody told me. And so, I mean, I'm very biased with this nurse continence advisor role, but just teaching that anatomy and physiology, how our body works, giving people permission to look at themselves, to see those tissues, to be comfortable with that, to have those conversations. It's a very privileged position.
And you know, and it's part of the work that you do, but people will tell nurses things that they don't tell other people, you know, other their families or sometimes other healthcare professionals. It's really a special relationship that we have with some of our patients. So I'm sure that's a real relief to the people that you care for to be so respectfully treated and given hope and options and see a path forward. So thank you.
There's no simple, when you say hope and options, I don't want to leave the message that there's an easy solution either, because it can take, and I always encourage people to be patient, because it can take, you know, 6 months or more for you to notice a difference, because it takes a while to heal a bladder that's been irritated for 40 years and to change those habits.
Yeah, that's really good to know.
So that was my initial assessment.
Oh,
and then and then I also provide follow-up assessments, but those are usually only 30 minutes long, depending if we have been able to complete the initial assessment in the first appointment. And then those 30 minute assessments are, I can do them on the phone or in person. It's just looking at where they were 2 months ago, what changes they've noticed, what questions they have for me, and I check their level of improvement and whether they would want to continue seeing me. So they'll usually see me for about 6 months to a year, I guess. And I only have those clinics once a month in each of those seniors health and wellness centers. So so it's a component of my CNS role, but it's not all of it. And then the other part is I do research there. So we've done one research project with some academics at UBC Okanagan about self-identifying with urinary incontinence. There's not a lot of research on urinary incontinence. It's not a sexy topic to research, and people are still not necessarily comfortable identifying that they have incontinence and then engaging in a study.
Yeah, lots of opportunity to learn more.
There's great opportunities.
Opportunity for research.
There is great opportunities. And I just think it's a great tool in your tool belt for any healthcare provider. You can do something, right?
Yeah.
Within your scope.
And that's great. That leads me to my next question. So if I have a patient, say I'm working, you know, anywhere, I'm not a nurse continence advisor, what are some things that you would like me to include in my assessment and my teaching with all patients related to incontinence?
Just to open the window for conversation that it's not normal. You could ask how much and what fluids they're drinking, because that's an easy place to start. So if they're not drinking enough, their urine will be concentrated, right? Mm-hmm. That's a bladder irritant. What other irritants are they taking in? So caffeine is a big culprit. Mm-hmm. And that caffeine includes chocolate, because chocolate has caffeine in it. It's all these good things. Alcohol. You know, many bladder irritants are also diuretics, so they're getting the double whammy. They're becoming dehydrated. Just talking about hydration, like water is so important. And we're so privileged in Canada that most of us have access to clean drinking water. So are they the other bladder irritants are like carbonated beverages, simple sugars, artificial sweeteners. We've come to the habit of not accepting water the way it is, but wanting to add something to it.
Yeah, and add some pizzazz.
Add some flavoring, or, you know, lemon. We often see people drinking water with lemon. And it's like everybody's different. And citrus can affect some people and not others.
Oh, okay.
Some foods, tomatoes. So I would just open the conversation of if you notice that someone's incontinent, or you've identified that they're leaking urine on an intake form or on your nursing assessment, just delve into that a little bit more with fluids and the hydration piece, because that can fit into almost anything that you're treating, like whether it's wound care or post-op surgery or medical issues. It's a place that you can incorporate. And then the other part is if they are interested in seeing a nurse continence advisor, and I never want to promise something that we can't deliver. So right now, both of us are attached to the Seniors Health and Wellness Centers, but there are private clinics. There's private physiotherapy clinics.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's not in the public system and it costs money. So it's not equitable. But people with the means, that's an option for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are, you know, people that have access to going down to the Lower Mainland. There's fantastic continence teams down there.
Okay.
And the best team, I think, is like a nurse continence advisor, a physiotherapist with pelvic floor function specialty, a dietitian. This is why it's such a privilege to work in the Seniors Health and Wellness Center, because we have these people. So they can take my assessment with constipation, for example, or IBS, constipation, diarrhea, back and forth, and layer on the dietitian assessment. Like maybe they're lactose intolerant and no one has ever brought that up, or they've never been tested. It's a bit like being a detective, I think, which kind of keeps my passion and my interest. There's the best website out there for continence in Canada is the Canadian Continence Foundation.
Okay.
And there's a great resource for the public called The Source that has some good pictures in it and goes through it in detail in lay language. You know, if they have any questions, they can always email me. I get a lot of healthcare providers contacting me with questions. You know, usually by the time healthcare providers have contacted me about certain patients, they've gone through the basic pieces already. And it can be about things like catheters or those sorts of things. So I can give them some tips. Again, catheters are not my specific area of expertise because I don't have the capacity to see people in my clinic for self-cath teaching and those sorts of things. Home care nurses pick that up, or wound ostomy incontinence nurses. But if we've exhausted all our resources in interior health, I've got a great collegial group too that I can put that question out to, and then they'll come back with recommendations or some tips too.
Great. That's really great to know. Can you tell me, I'm making an assumption, but I'm picturing myself with a patient who has urinary incontinence. And so if I was to talk about the importance of fluid intake and flushing the bladder to keep it healthy, or perhaps I'm talking about fluid intake in the context of constipation, I wonder if folks would feel reluctant if they would say, oh, well, I'm leaking urine, I don't want to drink more water. Is that a common thing?
It
and
is.
And what would you suggest? Yep. Just some teaching about?
And that's a question on my interview too, Allison, is do you restrict your fluids? And so I follow that up with, for example, if you were coming, if you were going out, you had an appointment or you're coming to see me, would you restrict your fluids because you think that you would leak less if you drink less?
Yeah.
And they'll often say yes. And I'll say, it actually works the other way around.
Okay.
If you restrict your fluids, your urine's concentrated and it's irritating your bladder and it's telling you to get rid of it. And it also puts you at risk for urinary tract infections. And then they start to think, and I say, I know it sounds the opposite to what you believe, but to leak less, you actually need to drink more. And then the other piece is, I don't want you to go home today and drink six cups of water.
Yeah.
Right. But then I give them a care plan to gradually increase the amount that they're drinking. And usually 6 to 8 cups is enough. But another rule of thumb is 30 mils per kilogram of body weight.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Then there's all these little tips that I give them. Like I encourage them, if they're having any issues with constipation, to drink 1 cup of hot water as soon as they get up in the morning, before they drink their tea or anything. Because what that does is it warms everything up. It stimulates peristalsis. People often think that their coffee in the morning stimulates their bowels, and it does. But they can often do that with just hot water. So they're getting the hydration in, they're warming everything up, and they're kickstarting themselves to success right away. And then another tip that I give them to reduce, so these are practical tips. And again, it puts locus of control towards them. So one other tip that I often give people that are getting up numerous times at night is I explain how all of us, we sit most of the day, well, or stand again, and fluid is accumulating in our periphery, like in our ankles, whether you see it or not. And then we go to bed and our feet are up. And so now your lymphatics are starting to work and they move that fluid up. You process it through your kidneys and you have to get up to pee. So I encourage them, if they can do this safely. Now, it's always that caveat with this patient population. If they can safely warm their feet up in a pan of hot water or put their feet in the tub to warm them up, then dry them off and get in a position where their feet are higher than their heart. So, and they stay there for about 15 minutes, making sure they're supporting their knees so that you don't have that stress on their knees. Staying there, and then this is about an hour and a half before you go to bed.
Okay.
So what that does is it jumpstarts that process. So warms up your periphery, your capillaries are all nice and open. Then get them higher than your heart. Your lymphatics are moving that through sooner rather than later. You're going to pee out more before you go to bed. And I always touch wood when I say this, but without exception, it's reduced the amount of times people get up at night.
Wow. I would never have thought to suggest that. That's
I didn't either,
tip.
Allison. I didn't know any of this stuff. But it's so practical. And I love practical things that people can do. Most people don't even understand the way their medication works. I mean, I have a hard time understanding how medication works. But most of us can understand how this works with our bodies. And when they come back for a follow-up appointment and they tell, you know, I'm still surprised. I should not be surprised of how it works. So yeah, that keeps my passion too.
Yeah, fantastic. And now you've alluded a bit to, I think, some barriers to recognizing incontinence. And I think one of the things you've mentioned is that there's a misconception that incontinence can be a normal part of aging, or an expected part of aging, I should say. And also the shame around incontinence. Do you have some things in mind that you think that we maybe in healthcare, or we just in general, get wrong about incontinence? So we have these misunderstandings about?
Well, we typically, historically, we've dealt with things in silos in healthcare, right? And the links to what we do with interventions and how it impacts bowel and bladder health, like Tylenol 3s, and especially with the elderly. So I think it's understanding, and we all had anatomy and physiology mm-hmm. courses, but I didn't get this in mm-hmm. my, I didn't appreciate it in yeah. my undergraduate program. And there's a delicate balance for opening that window for conversation mm-hmm. and building trust. And it certainly doesn't work as well when you do an internal vaginal exam without the upfront teaching and that understanding, I guess. Mm-hmm. And often with that initial assessment is the first time they've met me, where mm-hmm. they might already have a relationship with their physician.
Yeah.
So it's building that up front, making it a safe place to talk about, opening the conversation. And then it's so important, we alluded to this, is giving them some resources. I mean, you can go through this and say, it's not a normal process of aging. There's something you can do, but I don't have anybody to send you to. Yeah. But like I said, I think every one of us can pick up something, and there's some mm-hmm. great online resources, depending mm-hmm. on how people learn and all of that with adult learning.
Yeah, great. You shared about the source as mm-hmm. one of your favorite references mm-hmm. or resources, I mean, and you've spoken about your nurse advisor, continence advisor course, which I hope you're getting a cut on their commission for sending people to the program, because you're making it sound amazing. Do you have any resources that you would point nurses to if they're interested in learning more? Is there a conference yeah. that happens or yeah.
anything? There's a conference every 2 years.
Okay.
There's a great little handbook. So in this age of information, I get overwhelmed with
yes.
so much stuff, right? But this little handbook, I don't know if you can see it, and I can send mm-hmm. you the reference. It's the Canadian Nurse Continence Advisor Association okay. has put out a little handbook, and it's like this thick, right?
Yeah.
And it really is my Bible, my okay. go-to book. And you don't have to be a nurse continence advisor. It gives you the basics mm-hmm. of it all, and it's very user-friendly and usable. Okay. So that's another one. The Hartford, now again, I always refer back to my patient population. The Hartford Institute for Geriatric Care is, I think, the greatest website out there for care of older adults. Okay. They always have, they have videos. They have assessment sheets that are mm-hmm. the assessment on one side and then the evidence on the other side.
Oh, great.
They partnered with New York University. An interesting story is they received I forget how many million grant from a philanthropist to start much of this. So mm-hmm. I often start my presentations with that I'm looking for a philanthropist too.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be, if you don't have 10 million, that's okay. I'll accept yeah. whatever you got.
Yeah, love that.
But it's not funded like other programs. And, you know, maybe it's not going to save your physical life mm-hmm. like a cardiac intervention will. But when you think of quality of yes. life, it saves your life in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So true.
I had a lady when I was doing my preceptorship in the Lower Mainland that was 92 years old. And her and her husband were living in an apartment. She'd married a gentleman 10 years younger than her.
Okay.
Smart right there.
Yeah.
But she was on the brink of needing nursing home placement mm-hmm. because he and she was blind as well. And she hadn't gone out of her house in 2 years because her whole life was revolved around managing her incontinence. Yeah. And the things that I saw with how they managed them in her house opened my eyes to, as mm-hmm. a lot of home care nurses see.
Yes.
So just with her doing 6 weeks of Kegel exercises, mm-hmm. she had hope that yes. they would be able to stay together. So,
oh wow.
You know, and 92, if you think of 92-year-old yeah. muscles and teaching this stuff, we should be teaching this in elementary school.
Yes.
You know, we used to have health classes, but they've fallen by the wayside, mm-hmm. I think, because of a number of reasons.
We've picked your brain, Mary, and I know we've only just scratched the surface. I just want to give you the opportunity, if there's anything that you wanted to share today that you didn't get a chance to talk about, is there anything really important that we missed?
I can't think of anything. Just so people know, they can contact me.
Okay.
So mary.corbin@interiorhealth.ca if they have any questions. Okay. And if there's anything that I can do to support their career too. Mm-hmm. like I said, I'm biased, but I think this is a great tool in your tool belt yes. for whatever profession you're in. And man, if we can get to a team, a continents team
mm-hmm.
before I retire, that would yeah. be my goal.
Yeah. yeah, exactly. That's great. Well, I need to go drink some water, Mary.
Me
so
too.
I think we should let you go, but thank you so much for your expertise and sharing your time with us.
My pleasure. It's
very appreciated.
Right back at you, Allison. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Doing these.
Great. And as always, if you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at professionalpractice@interiorhealth.ca. And a special thank you to Interior Health Professional Practice Office for supporting this project. And a special thank you to our marvelous Dwayne Walwin, who is our sound editor and does all the magic behind the scenes. So thanks, Mary. We hope to see you again.
You bet. Have a good week. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. We know you're busy and your time is valuable. Thank you for spending some of it with us. Thank you for your commitment to your profession and to your patients and being a part of the journey of building a culture of excellence around nursing in our health region.